You know, we often talk about secrecy, excessive secrecy by the government, about cover-ups and conspiracies and lies. It would seem that excessive government secrecy, and we've certainly got a lot of it now, would be fundamentally at odds with our most important, our most cherished freedoms. You know, President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, we all remember this quote about him warning of the threat of the military-industrial complex. The guy who replaced him in the White House also had his concerns about excessive secrecy. And someone sent this to me, and I thought I might share it to provide a little bit of context for the discussion we're going to have with Dan Sheehan. This is John F. Kennedy speaking in 1963, I believe, about the threat to our democracy from excessive secrecy. Excessive secrecy, it's a fact of life in not only in relation to UFOs, but in relation to a whole heck of a lot of other stuff as well. Joining me now to speak about secrecy, conspiracies, and the possibility of disclosure is Daniel Sheehan. He's an attorney who was trained at Harvard College, Harvard Law School, Harvard Divinity School. He co-founded something called the Christic Institute, which has taken on some of the biggest and most important legal cases of our lifetimes, the Iran-Contra scandal back in the 80s, the Three Mile Island case, the Karen Silkwood case. Dan Sheehan was also legal counsel to the New York Times regarding the Pentagon Papers case. He represented the Daniel and Philip Berrigan during the Vietnam War. He's not afraid to take on big things. Daniel, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm out in Iowa right now. I'm out in the middle of the knee-deep snow, working in the presidential primaries out here.
You've worked for other political candidates as well. You know, the context of tonight, starting the conversation, is about disclosure. And, of course, part of this was kicked off the attention that was given to Dennis Kucinich about his incident. You've been a policy advisor to Kucinich, right?
Yes, I was his chief policy director during the 2004 presidential campaign and drafted his policy positions. In fact, the very first time that I ever met Dennis, I was introducing to him a United States Air Force colonel who had been witness to a major UFO incident. And since Dennis chaired the House Aeronautics Administration Committee, I brought the man to him. He was a citizen of the state of Ohio, and allowed him to present to Dennis the information that he had about this UFO incident. And that is how I met Dennis. And because of his openness and his candor about this issue, I was among the people that helped talk Dennis into running for the presidential election in 2004, and still remain a good friend of his. And he's campaigning here in Iowa for the presidential nomination. I happen to be working this year for John Edwards, because I believe that Edwards has a real opportunity to be the next president of the United States. And one of the major issues that I'm discussing with him and his policymakers is the possibility, after he is elected, of establishing a major commission, a peace and forgiveness commission similar to that was established in South Africa after the apartheid government was overthrown, to have the members of the apartheid government come forward and acknowledge what the criminal acts were that they had done in secret over many decades in order to reform the new government that was going to be coming in with the DNC. So that's one of the major issues that we're discussing here inside the campaign to try to bring John Edwards to the nomination for the Democratic Party and to challenge the Republican administration and the type of extraordinary excesses of secrecy and all of the damage that has been caused to our country and to the world over the last 8 years of this Republican administration, so that we can reveal all of those secrets. And I'm insistent upon not stopping there, but pointing out that we need to make an apology to the world, not only for the excesses that have been undertaken in the last two terms, but actually ever since the establishment of the National Security Act of 1947, the things that the President Kennedy was talking about in his speech in 1963, of course, were directed at that time against the Soviet Union, but the reality of it is that the principles that he was enunciating are as applicable to the national security state secrecy that was established here in the United States as are applicable to the Soviet Union. So I think that we in the United States, if we're going to establish the type of principles and ideals for which this country would like to be known, we're going to have to go through a major process of apologizing to the people of our world for what we've done and establish the principles that we stand for.
You know, given the nature of the topics that we cover on this program, we can't help but be political, but we do try to not be overtly partisan.
Yeah.
Danny, when we come back,
what I'm doing right now.
I understand. We're going to come back in just a moment. And when we do, I want to ask you whether you've had the UFO chat with the guy you're working for now, John Edwards. Stick around. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, George Knapp. My guest this evening is attorney Danny Sheehan, who's done some amazing things, tackled some amazing and controversial issues in his long legal career, founded something called the Christic Institute, and more recently the New Paradigm Institute, and is calling us tonight from Iowa, where he's working on the campaign of John Edwards. Danny, have you had that UFO chat with Edwards?
Well, not exactly. No, I've talked with a lot of the policy people here about the establishment of the Peace and Reconciliation Commission in general, talking about a number of the issues that need to be raised that go all the way back to the Kennedy assassination and to the whole Iran-Contra matter, the issues that were involved in the Southeast Asia war, et cetera. And I've talked with one of the people about the issue of UFOs, but I don't believe he has probably spoken with John about it. I just had a meeting with John about 3 hours ago. We were much more focused upon the specific issues that are going on out here right now, but I will have that conversation with him as soon as he gets the nomination, which will probably be have it wrapped up, I think, about February 5th or so.
Let's talk about the UFO disclosure. I really have grave doubts that it will ever happen. I mean, that they are ever going to, here's the files, and open up the doors at Area 51 and go in and kick the tires of the flying saucers or whatever. And in fact, Danny, I don't even know that the president would have the power to find all this stuff or even know about them. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's quite clear that despite things that have been said more recently by Jimmy Carter, it's perfectly clear that what happened when Jimmy Carter was elected back in November of 1976, that in December of 1976, prior to his coming into office on January 21st of 1977, President Carter met with the then director of the Central Intelligence Agency, George H.W. Bush, that's Bush 41, who at that time was still the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And when President Carter asked George Bush Sr. to reveal to him as the president-elect of the United States the details about the UFO phenomenon, George Bush Sr. Insisted at that point as a condition for him telling the newly elected president about this, that the president would have to agree to keep George Bush Sr. on as the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. And when President Carter, President-elect Carter, declined to do that and said that he had his own person that he wanted to put in, George Bush refused to give him the information and told him that he, as the new president, would have to contact the House Select Committee or the House Committee on Science and Technology and have them ask to have this information declassified in order to give it to the president, which is, that's an extraordinary historical development. But it demonstrates that a person such as George Bush Sr. would be in the position to know about a lot of this stuff, but would refuse to actually hand it over to the president on the grounds that it wasn't necessary for him to know this.
I guess the obvious question is, how do you know this? How do you know that George Bush made that demand?
Well, I knew this at the time because I was told this by Marcia Smith, who was the head of the Science and Technology Division of the Library of Congress Congressional Research Service, because she had been contacted by the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Representatives, pursuant to this set of conversations that took place, and asked to head up a special research project to seek the declassification of the information about UFOs to have them given to the president. And this was a discussion that I had with her back in 1977, in the late spring of 1977, just as she was coming on to become the head of the research group that was going to prepare the classified briefing for the president.
You know, that's it's kind of scary that you can have somebody who's elected president and they don't have the need to know, or apparently the right to know, all these UFO secrets. I wonder if those secrets are still there, that they could be disclosed, or whether they've been moved outside the purview of government.
Well, it's based upon my contacts with this issue, which we'll touch upon over the course of the next 3 hours, it's my opinion that that after the Roswell incident of July of 1947, it became quite clear that something like the Majestic 12 operation was established under Truman, and that there was some type of a decision made to move this uniquely sensitive issue out into an ultra-black program that appears to have been set. And as again, we'll touch upon throughout the course of the next 3 hours, it's quite evident that there have been secret programs that have been set up and have existed, which various presidents have not known about. That I know, for example, that when President Kennedy came into office in January of 1961, after having been elected in November of 1960, that neither he nor the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, were told about the existence of an ultra-secret political assassination team that had been assembled by Richard Nixon when he had been the vice president under Eisenhower from 1952 to 1960 to assassinate Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and Che Guevara. And that particular operation had been set up explicitly by Nixon in an effort to keep it concealed from the president. And I know directly about that one having been done, and I know that when President Carter was elected in November of 1976, we had this incident with the UFO matter, but there were a whole lot of programs that were going on in the operations director to the Central Intelligence Agency, which had been headed up by the ADDO, the Associate Deputy Director for Operations of the agency, Theodore G. Shackley, that were in fact concealed from President Carter at that time. So I know that this national security state apparatus that was set up in 1947 actually set up a whole series of blinds that would conceal programs from various people inside the executive branch and certainly from the legislature that they did not think they had any reason to know. And that's an extraordinarily dangerous situation during which we started to take on the very characteristics of the national security state that President Kennedy, in his opening remarks to the program here, used to criticize the Soviet Union.
So in that context, then, do you believe that whomever is elected president, whether it's your candidate or Hillary Clinton or Rudy Giuliani or whomever, if they had the idea going into office that they wanted to disclose this stuff, could one person do it, though that person is the president?
It would be quite difficult, and I think that's why I'm recommending to John Edwards, the candidate I'm working for this particular time, that such a major commission be reestablished, because we have to establish such a commission to basically start peeling away one layer at a time this encrusted secrecy that has come to grip our government now, to the point where we have people such as George W. Bush and Vice President Cheney having gone completely wild with this thing, where they're concealing information from other parts of the government, they're lying, they're going in and getting the Central Intelligence Agency to doctor intelligence information to generate the kind of political results that they're after. All of the very things that the people in 1947 who opposed the establishment of this national security state bureaucracy as the weapon of choice by means of which to counter the Soviet Union warned us about over and over again these dangers, and they have come to pass. And we have seen in the last 8 years of this administration the epitome of virtually every single one of the warnings that were given having come to full fruition.
I know that you have had some hands-on experiences with some of the materials that you'd like to see disclosed.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to get into that in the next hour after the break. But I wanted to discuss whether or not your opinion of the recent spate of news articles about UFOs, the interviews of the candidates, for example, and their statements, and then news conference calling for disclosure in Washington.
Yeah.
Are we twiddling our thumbs with this? Is it wishful thinking?
Well, it's a process, George. The process by means of which we're going to be able to peel away layer by layer this incrustation that has occurred around this issue is going to take some time. And my sense is that it has to start with a president that wants to get this to happen. It's going to then take a new head national security advisor who wants it to happen. It's going to take a head of a central intelligence agency that wants it to happen. It's going to take the chairman of the House and Senate Select Committee on Intelligence do this.
There's going to be
a number of people who have to come together as a coalition.
All right, we're going to get into that when we come back, taking a short break, and we're going to ask what UFO materials you've seen. Stick around. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. You know, people in the UFO field are always talking about disclosure issues and learning the full truth. Well, what about that? What about the wisdom of UFO disclosure? Have you thought about that? I mean, you know, maybe there's a good reason to keep it all secret. Maybe there's some horrible truth that would cause our social institutions to crumble if it was revealed to the public on a broad scale. My guest tonight, Daniel Sheehan, an attorney, has grappled with those kinds of questions. He's taken on the government and in terms of government secrecy and abuses of power. He knows that conspiracies are real, they really do happen, and he's had hands-on experience with some UFO material that you and I have never seen, and few other people have seen either. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him to tell you what that material was that he's held in his own hands and how he came to find it. Stick around. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, George Knapp. My guest this evening is attorney Daniel Sheehan, who founded the Christic Institute and also more recently the New Paradigm Institute. He's taken on some of the most important, most controversial legal cases of our lifetimes, and we're talking with him about UFO disclosure. Danny, when you were here in Las Vegas for the Crash Retrieval Conference, we had a chance to meet face-to-face and to talk about this question about the wisdom of UFO disclosure. What if there's some horrible truth that would come spilling out and cause our social institutions to crumble? And you've run up against that sort of thing in the past. Would you tell the listeners of the type of the times that you have run into those sorts of things in your legal work?
Well, I've run into a number of things, George, that were kept secret. That in virtually every case, they have made arguments similar to the hypothetical that you suggested, that there was something horrible that the American people couldn't really handle, that it shouldn't be revealed. These things have been discussed, for example, by Gary Sick, who was a member of the National Security Council under President Carter, Jimmy Carter, back from 1976 to 1980. He wrote a book called The October Surprise, in which he, in the conclusion of the book, points out that those of us who have lived in Washington, D.C. for 20 years or more have become used to this issue of scandals and secrets. And we've run into secrets, for example, that when some senator or something is caught having an affair or is dipping his hand into the till and taking money out of his campaign for his private use, et cetera, these types of scandals are readily revealed, and that all the people in Washington swoop upon a person like that who is foolish enough to have gotten caught doing something petty like that, and they reveal to the country this scandal, thereby giving people the impression that scandals will, in fact, be surfaced and revealed. But he points out in his book that there is a whole other category of scandal, And that is the type of secret that, if revealed to the American public, wouldn't reveal something that the people would otherwise not be able to handle, but it would reveal a type of venality on the part of their governors who want to keep these types of secrets and keep their mistakes secret from the American people, the concealment of which would so trouble the American people that they would ultimately lose confidence in their governors. That's the real key, and that's what President Kennedy was talking about in his opening remarks in the show, is that these excuses for secrecy are almost always really a cover for the people who are in positions of power to conceal their own mistakes, the things that we need in a democracy to know about in order to cure those problems. And
mistakes, but also concealing their mistakes, using the excuse of national security
to hide
evidence of crimes as
That's right.
Didn't you run into some of this in the Silkwood case, the Karen Silkwood case?
Oh, yes, yes. For example, that in the Karen Silkwood case, we uncovered the fact that that Karen Silkwood, who was a young woman working at the Kerr-McGee nuclear facility in Oklahoma back in 1973, that she had been suspicious that they were being very sloppy at the nuclear plant, where they were reprocessing spent nuclear fuel, waste materials from around the 103 nuclear reactors around the country. They were reprocessing it at that plant and extracting from the waste material enriched plutonium. And they were then condensing it into little pellets, and they were compacting them and putting them into steel tubes to be sent to the fast flux test facility out at Hanford in Washington. And what she discovered in her looking around trying to find evidence of how sloppy they were and that they were spilling plutonium, she discovered that they were missing 40 pounds of bomb-grade plutonium. And so she got on the telephones and she called Tony Mazzocchi, the head of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, for which she worked in Washington, and she revealed to them, to him and to Steve Wodka, his assistant, that she had discovered these documents that were classified, that were showing that they were missing 40 pounds of plutonium, and that when David Burnham from the New York Times came out to retrieve copies of these documents from her, she was killed. Her car was rammed and run off the road and hit a concrete abutment, and she was killed, and they took all the documents from her car before anyone could get there. We came in to investigate that, and when we discovered those documents, we began to investigate it, and we then learned that, in fact, it wasn't that they were being terribly sloppy, as she had suspected. What it was is they were smuggling 98% pure bomb-grade plutonium out of that facility and smuggling it to Israel to give Israel an atomic bomb. And because of Israel having gotten the atomic bomb, you then began to get others, such as, you know, Pakistan wanting to get a nuclear bomb. And then you got, you know, you've gotten Iran trying to get a nuclear bomb. And you see that type of foolishness that was supported in that case secretly by the Central Intelligence Agency is exactly the kind of stuff they would try to keep secret, the point where they would kill an American citizen like Karen Silkwood to keep her from turning that information over to the New York Times. And when we revealed that to the federal judge, we gave an affidavit to Judge Frank Tice, who was the federal judge in that case, and he was immediately contacted by the Central Intelligence Agency and asked to hold a secret hearing behind closed doors with the judge, not telling us about it on the other side, and asking to suppress all of that information. Well, Judge Tice told me that he was being asked to go into chambers to talk about this with the CIA. He asked me to come to the chambers on Monday morning. I went there, and then along comes Glenn Whitaker, the attorney for the FBI. He comes into the room with two men from the Central Intelligence Agency. They go into closed chambers with the judge, and about 10 minutes later, in comes Cy Hirsch, the investigative reporter at that time for the New York Times. He now works for the New Yorker magazine. But he came in and he said, "Danny, what's going on here?" And I told him about what was going on. And about 10 minutes later, Judge Tice comes out and he gets on the bench. And on the record, he says, "Well, Mr. Sheehan," he says, "you can be certain that it's sinister, but it's also most definitely secret. This is just a glass mountain that you're not going to be allowed to climb in this case." And he said, "And I'm at this point dismissing the count one out of your federal lawsuit in which you charge that Ms. Silkwood's rights to the First Amendment, freedom of the press, were interfered with by interfering with her being able to meet with the New York Times. Her First Amendment rights to freedom of travel on the public highways was interfered with. Her right to life was she was deprived of under the Fourth Amendment by officials. And he said, I'm going to rule at this time that the Federal Civil Rights Act protects only black people. I'm taking judicial notice of the fact that the Federal Civil Rights Act was passed in 1868, following the end of the Civil War, and the Civil War was fought solely for the purpose of freeing the black race from slavery, and therefore the Federal Civil Rights Act must apply only to black people. And so therefore, since you haven't even alleged that Ms. Silkwood was a member of the Negro race, I'm going to dismiss your lawsuit.
Oh, my gosh.
And all of that was just designed to keep it secret that now the federal judicial branch knew that they were smuggling plutonium to Israel. The executive branch knew it. The CIA knew it. I now knew it. But they went to the lengths of compromising the very integrity of our legal system by insisting that the Federal Civil Rights Act only applies to black people as a means of stopping us from revealing that information in the Karen Silkwood case. So I took that information and brought it to the legislative branch. We brought it to John Dingell, who was chairing the House Subcommittee on Commerce, and we gave it to him. And what he did is he called in Stansfield Turner and confronted him behind closed doors with this information. And Stansfield Turner lied to them and said that, oh, no, it wasn't true at all. And that he couldn't declassify the papers to even show them to the congressional committee because they didn't have adequate security clearances. But the fact of the matter is we've run into this over and over again. I ran into it when I was only 25 years old. I'd come out of Harvard. I was at the Harvard Law School, was co-editor of the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review. I went down to the Wall Street law firm of Cahill Gordon, Sonnet, Rindell and Ohl, and I was one of the associates under Floyd Abrams. And we at that time were representing the New York Times in a case that I happened to have done the case when I was still in law school that went on to the Supreme Court and established the right of journalists to protect their confidential news sources. I actually initiated that case when I was 25.
Well, thank you for that, by the way.
You're perfectly welcome. It was my privilege. And we were doing that case in the United States Supreme Court for NBC. The New York Times came on to be an amicus. They wanted to support our position in front of the Supreme Court. So I was working directly with the legal office of the New York Times, and we got a call. I got a call actually. I received the call at my office on Wall Street from the legal counsel of the New York Times. And he contacted me and said he wanted to have an emergency meeting with me and with Floyd Abrams. And so he comes to the office that morning and revealed to us that they had just gotten handed 47 volumes of classified documents in the Pentagon Papers. That they didn't tell me at that time who the source of it was, but I'm the one that recommended that we publish those, that we put those on the front page of the New York Times. And he said, well, what's going to happen? And I said, well, probably Richard Nixon and John Mitchell will try to accuse you of espionage. And he said, espionage? You know, why would they do that? And I said, because it's the strongest tool they've got. They're going to use everything they can to keep this secret. And we went ahead and did it. And it took 13 days from the beginning of that case to the end of it, in which we won the right to publish the Pentagon Papers case. So we published the Pentagon Papers on the front pages of the New York Times and revealed, among other things, that in fact the entire Bay of Tonkin resolution that the Congress of the United States had been persuaded to sign, giving President Johnson the authorization to use military force to commit U.S. military troops into Southeast Asia and Vietnam, was predicated upon a complete lie. That they fabricated the evidence, pretending that boats, torpedo boats, had attacked the USS Henry Knox in the Bay of Tonkin, and it was completely untrue, and they knew that it was untrue, and that was revealed in the New York Times on the front pages, and it was one of the major body blows to the executive branch that began the end of the Vietnam War. So, but that attempt to lie and conceal things to bring us into war, to smuggle plutonium to Israel to create a nuclear weapon for them and destabilize the Middle East, these are the types of secrets that they use national security to attempt to conceal from the American people. Very, very seldom do they ever actually conceal something that if the people of the United States found out about it, that it would somehow traumatize them too much. This issue of the UFO matter, the fact of the matter is that 63% or more of the American people at the present time believe that UFOs are real, and they believe that the American government is concealing information from us. You know, so that for the executive branch to continue to pretend that they can't acknowledge that there is such a thing as extraterrestrial civilization, or that at least some of these UFOs may well be vehicles from another star system, you know, because it would be too traumatic to our American people that somehow the stock market would collapse or something, is ridiculous. Because the vast majority of people believe it's true. What we're more traumatized about is the fact that our government is lying to us and our government is concealing things from us, that the confidence that people need to have in their government to really make our government work effectively and efficiently is going down and down every single generation. So that's a much greater danger to us than knowing about the details of an extraterrestrial civilization. We're perfectly prepared to start planning for how we're going to have diplomatic relations with this extraterrestrial civilization, how we're going to have commercial relations with them, social relations with them. We need to turn our attention to what type of policies we really want to have. But they refuse to do that. They refuse to allow the American people to participate in an intelligent conversation about what type of relations we ought to have with these beings by simply saying, well, it isn't true.
And do you believe there are active programs of disinformation and to encourage ridicule of those who are interested in the program?
I have no doubt about that at all. In fact, Richard Dolan, a very sound and responsible investigative reporter, has written a book called UFOs in the National Security State, in which he has publicly revealed the actual existence of internal memoranda that were prepared by the United States Air Force, in which they explicitly state that they are engaged in an active campaign to ridicule and to attack the credibility of people whom they know, American citizens whom they know are telling the absolute truth about this, and that they've actively engaged in deceiving people and attacking their character in telling the world that they're liars and ridiculing them.
I know that there was the Robertson panel sponsored by the CIA back in, I believe, 1953, which came out with the recommendations to enact a policy of debunking wherein UFOs are stripped of their aura of mystery.
Yeah.
Because UFOs are not perceived as a threat, but reporting of UFOs and interest in UFOs might be a threat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But it's
important to remember, and you and I have talked about this before, I mean, from October of 1917, when the Bolshevik Revolution took place in the Soviet Union, all the way up to December 31st of 1991, when the Soviet Union voluntarily dissolved itself, the United States was engaged in a confrontational dialectic with the Soviet Union, that each of them declaring the other to be the ultimate other, and that they were ever the epitome of evil. And the fact of the matter is, during that entire period of time, it was perfectly evident that if the United States encountered an extraterrestrial vehicle of any sort, all they would do is see it as a potential source of a high technology that they could use as a weapon in its struggle against this ultimate evil. That, you know, there's this old aphorism, they have a Sufi aphorism, that when a pickpocket meets a saint, all the pickpocket sees is his pockets. And this perception, that when one has a distorted perception and is caught in a dialectical confrontation like this over an almost 80-year period, it totally distorts the perception that people have. And that's what I think happened here, that when our national security state mindset encountered these mysterious vehicles, that many people, such as you know, Philip Corso himself, you know, saw this technology as a great source of obtaining some type of military advantage over the Soviet Union. And worse yet, they perceived it as an essential mission of the United States to figure out what this UFO technology was so we could begin to develop some type of a weapon system to protect ourselves against the civilization from which the UFOs came. All of this is just the mindset of a national security state. It's not the mindset of a democracy, an open democracy, where people are attempting to establish peaceful and productive and mutually beneficial relations with each other. That's what we have to do now. That's the task of our generation, the post-World War II generation, the post-Cold War generation, and that's what we were attempting to do at the State of the World Forum with President Gorbachev and Senator Alan Cranston and Ted Turner and others, you know, from 1995 all the way up to 2001, we were trying to, at the end of the Cold War, identify a post-dialectical worldview that we could actually implement and move into place prior to the time that some new ultimate enemy was created. That's what we were trying to warn people about in the Iran-Contra case. We were trying to point out to them that, look, we're approaching the end of the Cold War now. We filed the Iran-Contra case in May of 1986, and we prosecuted that case from 1986 all the way up to 1991, and we were saying, look, the fact is, what we're witnessing here is a desperate effort on the part of people from the national security state to generate some new enemy. Now, they're afraid they're going to lose the Soviet Union as their adversary to be able to justify all of their multi-billions of dollars of expenditures and military expenditures and intelligence activities. And what they're going to try to do is they're going to try to generate a whole new set of enemies using the rationale of anti-terrorism.
Danny, I'm going to have to interrupt you here. We're going to have to go to a break. We'll come back with more on that. And I'm sorry to keep teasing our listeners by saying that we're going to talk about the UFO material you handled, but I promise you we're going to get to that when we come back after this break. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stick around, folks. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're having a fascinating discussion with attorney and crusader Danny Sheehan of the New Paradigm Institute. Danny, I want to give you a chance to finish your thoughts on the Iran-Contra scandal and case that you fought back in the 80s, and then we'll move on to your own hands-on experience with UFO stuff.
Well, this was all just by way of setting in context this key issue of the secrecy surrounding the UFO phenomena. It's to show that it is part of a larger mindset that has obtained ever since the enactment of the National Security Act in 1947. And it's in that context that I think we need to appreciate what this is so that we don't think that this particular issue of secrecy is any more impossible to uncover than the many others that we have succeeded in uncovering in the past. And so there's hope for this. It's not insurmountable. But to turn our attention directly to the issue of the particular UFO information that I've come into contact with, the initial experience that I had with this occurred back in 1977. As I'd indicated, when President Carter was elected in November of 1976 and attempted in December of 1976 as the president-elect to get then CIA Director George Bush Sr. to reveal to him as the president-elect the information, the secret classified information about UFOs, as I indicated, the CIA director refused to give it to him and insisted that the president go through this process of contacting the House Science and Technology Committee and having the House Science and Technology Committee contact the Library of Congress, that is the actual entity that takes the steps to declassify information. It was in the context of that undertaking that I was contacted in the late spring of 1977, after the president had come into office in January and the process had been underway. I was called by Marcia Smith, who was the director of the Science and Technology Division of the Congressional Research Service, of the Library of Congress. I, at that time, was chief counsel for the United States Jesuit Order in Washington, D.C., and in that context, Marcia contacted me and asked me if I might be willing to participate as a special consultant to the Congressional Research Service project that they were undertaking on behalf of the president. She wanted me to contact the Vatican Library in Rome and see if the Jesuit director of the Library of Congress, the library in the Vatican, would be willing to allow me to go and get access to the secret sections of the Vatican Library that might contain information about UFOs, potential extraterrestrial intelligence that might be known by the Vatican. So I told her that I would be happy to do that. And I contacted the Jesuit head of the Vatican Library. He wrote a letter and asked him if I could have access to this information. And much to my surprise, he wrote back and said no. So I wrote him a second letter saying, I don't think you really understand, you know, that I'm asking you on behalf of the Jesuit Order of the United States, and we're trying to work with the President of the United States to get this information. And he still refused.
Wow.
And so I said, well, I contacted Marcia, and I apologized. I said, gee, I thought we might be able to get this, but we can't. She said, that's fine. And she then contacted me a short while later. It must have been a few weeks later. And she told me that an event had happened where the Congress of the United States had cut over half of all of the funds for the SETI program, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence that was undertaken at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in California. That's where, as you know, they direct large radio telescopes, such as the one down in Puerto Rico and other places. They direct the radio telescopes into space, and they collect together in this great huge dish radio signals that are coming from the various star systems throughout the galaxy and throughout the universe to attempt to ascertain whether there are intelligent signals that are actually being sent to our Earth. And it's, now many people, of course, consider this an extraordinarily inefficient way to go about trying to determine whether extraterrestrial civilization exists, but it's one of the ways that is undertaken. She told me that since half of the money had been cut out of the budget for the SETI program, she wanted to know if I would be willing, as the chief lobbyist for the United States Jesuit Order, who had indicated an interest in trying to get information about extraterrestrial intelligence, whether I would be willing to participate with a number of former astronauts to go around to visit the offices of the congressional members and the Senate members to talk them into putting the money back into the budget. I did that. We did that for a matter of a couple of weeks. We succeeded in getting the money put back into the budget. And the scientists out at the SETI program at JPL were very happy and wanted me to come and to deliver a three-hour closed-door seminar to the top 50 scientists in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence on the theological implications of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So I contacted Marcia, and I said, look, in order to do this, I would like to be able to have some access to any of the information that you are gathering in the context of getting this information for the president, so I can have sort of up-to-date information about what we do know. And she said, well, what kind of information would you want? Of course, I immediately knew. I said, what I want to do is get access to the classified sections of Project Blue Book, which was the major undertaking on behalf of the United States Air Force to investigate the UFO phenomenon. And
widely derided, that program widely derided. Right,
exactly. Because all of the really good information they got was concealed and classified, and what they did is they just you know, set up this fictional public report about, you know, discrediting every contact and calling even the most extraordinary photographs and everything, various things from swamp gas to indigestion on the part of the person who saw it. And as you say, it was totally non-credible. But I said to her, I would like to get access to the classified portions of Project Blue Book. She said that, well, she thought it was quite unlikely that they would agree to do that, but she would try. And much to both of our mutual pleasure, she contacted me a couple weeks later and said, to her surprise, they'd agreed to do this. And what they, she said, on Saturday morning, you can go over to the Library of Congress, the new wing. There was a whole new building at the Library of Congress that they had just finished building. There was nobody in it. There was, the offices were all brand new and completely empty. And she said, but you can go over there on Saturday morning if you present your identification. They have some of these documents for you. So I went over on Saturday morning. I showed my identification to this guard at the door. They let me in. They brought me in and escorted me downstairs. I go down this elevator down to the second floor. There was really nobody in the whole building, as I said. And I walked down the hall, and there were these two or three men in suits, whom we call suits in the profession. They were security people. They were like Secret Service people. And they were standing in front of the door of this room. So I went down, there's a little table there, and I went in. I had my briefcase with me. I had a yellow pad under my arm, and I went in. I was in my suit and tie and everything. I went in, showed them my identification. They told me that I would be allowed a certain amount of time to go into the room to look at these documents, but I had to leave my briefcase there, and I wasn't allowed to take any notes or anything. So I said, well, here I go. So I leave my briefcase outside the room. I go in the room. And in this room, they were against both of the right-hand wall and left-hand wall, these big tables with boxes on them. And then right in front of me, another two tables with a bunch of, they were like shoe boxes. They were the size of shoe boxes. And I looked in them, and they were, each of them was filled with little canisters of
microfish.
Microfilm, actually. And so what I did is I took them, I opened up the box, and it turns out they had one of those little microfiche machines, those little tin machines with a hand crank on the side of it where you put the tape in there. So I began to go through these boxes and looking for something. I didn't know how long I was really going to be in there, how long I was going to get. I viewed this as kind of an extraordinary opportunity, and I wanted to see what I could find. So I started looking through the microfiche, and I was...
Hold on just a second. Hold on, Danny. I'm sorry to interrupt you again. We need to take a short break here, and when we come back, you're going to tell us what you saw on that microfilm. Stick around. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your host this evening. My guest is attorney Daniel Sheehan. He's telling us a remarkable story about being able to see some of the classified files from Project Blue Book. Okay, Danny, you're in this building with the help of Marcia Smith.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So
what'd you see?
So there I am in this room, and these three guys outside guarding the door out there, and I'm going through these microfiche, and I'm looking. I'm trying. I said, I don't know how long I'm going to get in here, so I'm looking kind of through these things, and after, it must have been about maybe 40 minutes or so, I come upon this picture. It's a picture of what is absolutely clearly a UFO, and it's on the ground. It's clear that it's hit. There's snow in the pictures. In a huge gully has been dug across this field where this UFO had hit in this field, and it plowed across the field, and it was stuck in the side of a bank, a big mud bank, but there was snow on it, and it was kind of sticking out at like a 45-degree angle, and there were United States Air Force people all around this thing that you could see them in their hoods. It was a big furry things around their hoods. You could see the name tags they had on them. They were clearly Air Force people, and they had cameras and actually a film. It was an actually film camera. You could see them in the photograph taking film footage of this thing. And I then went to the next picture, and it was another picture of the same thing from a different view. So I started looking through these two, three pictures, and when I got to the fourth picture, I think I could see that there was some kind of they were like symbols that were along the bottom. It was a classic UFO, the saucer shape with a dome on the top of it, and I could see along the very base of the little bulb on the top, the thing, I could see these symbols along the side of it. So I said, gee, I'm going to look to these pictures, advance this thing away, and see if I can get a close-up of these. I go through a couple more pictures, and there it was. It was kind of a close-up picture of these symbols along the bottom of the dome of this UFO. So what I did is I looked there, I was first trying to see if I could read any of the names on the name tags of any of these Air Force guys around there, but I couldn't get a clear enough there wasn't a clear enough picture of these things. Obviously, if we could get the pictures now, we could digitize them and get the names off there. which I'll tell you a story about later. But bottom line is I look at this and I get a close-up picture enough of these symbols. So what I did is I looked around to see if these guys were watching, and I take the yellow pad that I brought in with me, and I open it up, and I open up all the pages to the back cardboard section. And I slid it in under the little microfiche machine, and I adjusted the focus on this thing so that the picture was the exact same size as the cardboard backing. And on the inside side of the cardboard, I traced exactly every one of the symbols that was around the base of this particular dome of this UFO so that I'd have it absolutely exactly right. And I traced them all out. I closed up the yellow pad. I took the picture, I took the little microfiche off, and I rolled it back up and put it in the canister, put it back into the shoebox, and closed up the yellow pad and got up from the place. I said, look, okay, I've got it now. I just want to get out of here so I don't get caught with this. So I get up, and I kind of, you know, casually strolled to the door, and the three guys were out there. And I said, okay. And I started to walk out, and I said, can I have my briefcase back? And they went out and got the briefcase, and they handed it to me. And I started to walk away, and one of the guys said, hold it. What's that you got there under your arm? And I said, oh, that's just a yellow pad. And he said, I told you couldn't take any notes. He takes the yellow pad, and he flips through the yellow pages of it. And, of course, there was nothing on any of them. And so he hands it back to me. And I put it back into my arm, and I walked out of the place and got out of there with these things. And I went back to the office, and I called Father Bill Davis, who was my immediate superior at the Jesuit office, had him come in, and I showed this to him, and I told him what I had seen. And he did this interesting thing. He said, look, I've never told anybody this, but my sister is married, her husband is an air traffic controller at the Seattle Washington airport, and one of his best friends is a pilot, and he gave him this, and he goes to his desk and he slides open the drawer and he hands me a picture of a UFO that his sister's husband's friend had taken out of the window of a commercial airliner that he'd seen. So he handed that to me, and he said, so I just want you to know that you have my support in pursuing this. So I put the photograph into the yellow pad, and I've got it still. And so I got this thing, and I said, this is really extraordinary. And so I then had a basis for now going to SETI. I go out to California to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I delivered this big seminar to these top 50 scientists. And then later on, Marcia completed the investigation. They actually filed two at that time classified reports. One of them was an analysis of the probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilization, that is, another sentient, highly technologically evolved, intelligent civilization. And the second report was on the UFOs themselves. How many different shapes there were, how many times they've been seen, et cetera. And they prepared these two reports, and they came to the conclusion, this is the official United States Congressional Research Service report to the president. It was given to him in 1977, and they came to the conclusion that there were from 2 to 6 other sentient, highly intelligent, highly technically evolved civilizations in our own galaxy, in addition to our own, and gave it to the president.
You know, I've seen a copy of a report that Marcia Smith wrote in preparation for members of Congress. Yeah. A Nevada U.S. senator gave me a copy of it several years ago, and I'm sure it's based on some of the same information. I don't know if it's as sensitive as the one you're talking about.
I'm sure. Yeah. That was the first instance that I had with any of these things. And
did you? I'm sorry, Danny. Did you tell that story to the SETI guys about what you'd just seen?
No, I told them that I was convinced that it was true, that there was other civilizations, and that what they were looking for, they were going to find. I made it clear to them that, and I actually directed my attention to the theological implications. I was saying that, look, the fact is you think that you're looking for another intelligent civilization, but it's not just our intellect that is the key to our human species. The fact of the matter is that intellectus The Latin root of intelligence is intellectus, is the ability to distinguish the difference between. That if we only find other beings that are able to distinguish the difference between themselves and us, we've got trouble. What we're really looking for is those who have the same faculty, the intuitive faculty, to be able to experience the unitive phenomenon that bonds us all together in the universe. These are the people that we're looking for. These are the beings that we're looking for. And I critiqued Carl Sagan's The Dragons of Eden and did a long explication to them. I told two of them that I had seen this thing. When I was talking to them privately, I asked them to show me. I said, who among all of you is going to be the first person to know that you've actually obtained an intelligent signal from another world? And they all looked at each other kind of baffled. It took them a couple of minutes to figure out exactly who that was going to be. And it turned out to be the brother of Pete Seeger, the famous folk singer. His brother was one of the top 50 scientists at SETI, and he's the guy that actually sits there and looks at the old data that's come in, and he kind of files through, you know, this data. They download it all and put it into computers, and then he prints them all out, and he ends up kind of going through them, and he's like, you know, weeks behind what the real-time stuff is they're getting, and it turns out he was going to be the person who actually knew before anyone else. And so I got him to give me his private home phone number, and I gave him mine so that he could call me in case he found it.
Good move. Hey, I'm curious about the symbols that you mentioned.
Yes.
That you traced off that crashed disk.
Yes.
Have they ever been published? Have you ever done anything with them?
No, I've got those still. I've got to. That I keep trying to figure out who in the world to give them to. That if I can get one of the presidents to listen to this, or one of the candidates, that I'll show them to it. In fact, I should show them to people the next time I do a presentation at any one of these conferences, because I just haven't. I've got them all in my files. I got to go dig them out and bring them to them.
Well, I'll tell you, I sure would like to get a look at them myself, and
maybe we can
make an arrangement for that. And the same thing with the photo from the.
Yeah, I can show you both. Yeah.
So basically, you confirmed that there are a whole heck of a lot of things, secrets being kept about this topic by the military, by our government. And since it didn't seem to mess you up too badly, I guess maybe the rest of us could handle it as well. We'll be right back with more of our interview with Daniel Sheehan on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is attorney Daniel Sheehan, and he's just been telling us a remarkable story about his opportunity to examine the classified portions of the Blue Book records, things that you and I have never had a chance to see. Included in those records were photographs of an apparent crashed disk surrounded by Air Force personnel who were there to photograph and document it and presumably to study it. And as Daniel Sheehan told us, there were symbols, some sort of a foreign unknown language printed on the side of this thing. What I want to know is whether there was any kind of text or details in that report that would explain what was going on, where that crash site occurred, what it was, what conclusions they reached. And we're taking a short break now. When we come back, I'm going to put those questions to our guest, Dan Sheehan. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. My guest is attorney Daniel Sheehan of the New Paradigm Institute. Danny, you saw the photos.
Yeah.
You traced the symbols. Was there anything along with that stuff to explain what the crash was, what it represented?
Well, actually, I didn't find anything. What I did is I came upon those photographs, and that it was, you know, I've kicked myself, you know, 100 times since then, but it was about not, you know, staying in there longer, looking in other files to try to find out what the heck that was. But I know that it was obviously in the north, sort of, because it was all snow in the winter. I know they were United States Air Force people, but I don't know exactly when it was. But I can tell that the vintage of the film, the camera that they were using to film it, was an older type of, it was film. It wasn't video camera, wasn't anything like that. So it looked like somewhere like in the 60s or something like that, but I didn't get it. And the problem is I bundled it all up and sort of got out of there, perhaps faster than I should have. I was afraid of kind of losing what I had gotten, so I just left, and I never had another opportunity to go back in there to get it. But now that was in 77. you know, it was before I'd finished the Karen Silkwood investigation, which we did all the way through to 1979. It was before the Iran-Contra stuff. It was before I kind of realized that in addition to being an attorney, I had to be kind of an investigator in order to try to get a lot of this stuff done. So it was unfortunately a little too early in my career to have been smarter than I was at the time.
Anything else of note in this material you saw? I mean, what made up the bulk of the stuff you went through there? Was it just UFO sighting reports?
Yeah, they were different. There were different kinds of reports, and there were different kinds of documents and data and stuff like that. Some of them were the kind of things that later on that Richard Dolan got his hands on, you know, through the Freedom of Information Act and stuff. There were some internal files and stuff about the things that they were doing and the reports that they were getting and the kind of the fact that they were being instructed to kind of downplay things, to try to come up with any explanation they could for these sightings, any rational explanation they could come up with, and that was all it was. But it wasn't anything hardcore at the time.
Makes you wonder where those files are now, whether they would still be active. If Richard Dolan got some of them through Freedom of Information Act, whether or not they're accessible. Rest of it.
Well, I'm sure they are. They're somewhere. I'm sure of that. And what we need to do, as I had said before, that we need to get a coalition of people inside an administration. Now I tend to agree with you, George. I mean, for us to be all sitting around waiting for the United States government to somehow come to its own decision by whatever means, of negotiating with the internal bureaucracy somehow to decide whether or not to do this, I think that what we need to do is put it on the agenda with a kind of peace and reconciliation commission that we could put together under an Edwards administration or any other one. That we would have to have congressional people involved. We'd have to have, in my opinion, judicial officers from the judicial branch involved, the attorney general involved. You know, it would be ideal if we could get an attorney general, somebody like Mario Cuomo or something, somebody that almost everybody loves and trusts. You know, to come in as an attorney general to supervise this and to bring in trusted people, you know, ideally new Supreme Court justices. For example, if Lawrence Tribe from Harvard were to get appointed to the new seat that's going to be vacated in the next administration, or people that can be trusted, and bring in a coalition of people to do this. I think that's the way this thing is going to have to be done, and it'll be not just the UFO thing, but it'll have to do with the Kennedy assassination, it'll have to do with the illegal narcotic smuggling that's been going on by the Central Intelligence Agency over years to fund covert political assassination programs, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of these kind of secrets that need to be undone, but none of them more important than the UFO secret.
We talked earlier, I don't know if you heard the first hour of the program, but I mentioned a news story from the past week, one of those torture taxis, the rendition planes used by a CIA front that crashed in Mexico, and they found a couple of tons of cocaine in it.
That would be right.
So you think that's still going on?
Oh, sure, that's still going on. Absolutely still going on. You know, we've tracked this all the way from back with Vang Pao. I mean, Carl Jenkins, who was the CIA liaison officer from the CIA station in Saigon under Theodore Shackley, to Vang Pao, who was the major opium trafficker throughout the entire Vietnam War. You know, I've spent hours talking to him and debriefing him and getting the information, that I know that they were doing it all through that period. I know they were doing it down in Colombia. I've interviewed Joseph Smith, who was the deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City back in 1974, and he's acknowledged to me that he was confronted by people that were involved in the Colombia cocaine cartel, and they made it a condition of him being allowed to stay on as the deputy CIA station chief that he agree not to do anything to interfere with the cocaine smuggling, because they were using portions of the profits from it to fight what they called the War Without Boundaries, which was a political assassination program in El Salvador and down through South America to assassinate people who were liberals and progressives and labor union people. So, you know, I know that they've been doing this. I did the Sabo case, Colonel James Sabo, in the year 2000. That I know that they that we were doing an investigation of the activities under the Bush senior administration, where they were smuggling cocaine in from Colombia in the same planes they were flying weapons illegally down to the right-wing death squads down in Colombia. So this has been a modus operandi of the Central Intelligence Agency, dating all the way back into the end of World War II, when Richard V. Secord and Jack Singlaub and those guys were all involved in setting up the opium trafficking that helped support the Kuomintang, the nationalist Chinese with Chiang Kai-shek. It was a major source of funding for them. A fellow by the name of CIA operative by the name of Paul Halliwell, you know, ran a thing called the Sea Supply Corporation, SEA, Southeast Asian Supply Corporation. It was a corporation set up down in Miami Beach in Florida, and they were processing the opium and heroin trafficking from Southeast Asia, purchasing weapons for the Kuomintang to fight the communist Chinese of Mao. This has been going on throughout that entire period. So that this is something that's been going on, is still going on. We see now that the huge increase in the opium production going on in Afghanistan, where the people growing the heroin there are in fact the people who are the warlords that the Central Intelligence Agency and the American government have now put into power in Afghanistan to try to fight the Taliban. This type of pattern has been going on now for the entire duration of the National Security Act, and it's got to be exposed. It's one of the many things that needs to be put in front of a commission with the new administration to purge these kind of dark secrets from our past so that we can apologize to the people of the world for what we've done and reestablish our credibility in the world.
I want to return to a brief mention that you made about Gorbachev. I know from your resume that you'd done some work with one of his events in San Francisco, I think.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories about Gorbachev which relate to Ronald Reagan and whether or not these two guys talked about UFOs. You know, there were several statements that Ronald Reagan made in public that sort of alluded to a extraterrestrial intelligence threat from outer space, and Gorbachev sort of responded. Do you have any knowledge about whether or not there was a conversation between the two about UFOs?
No, but this is the first thing I ever talked about with Gorbachev when I met him. I said to him that Dr. James Garrison, who is the president of the Gorbachev Foundation, was one of my best friends from Harvard Divinity School. He was on my staff at the Jesuit National Headquarters. In fact, I'm the one that sent Jim Garrison to the Soviet Union to, at that time, meet Brezhnev. And he talked with Brezhnev's doctor, and then he talked with Andropov's people, and then he talked with Gorbachev. And that's how he ended up being the head of the Gorbachev Foundation, that he introduced me to Gorbachev. And the first thing I asked Gorbachev was about the UFO issue.
What did he say?
Well, he smiled, and he gave me the name of a guy to call. He just wrote this thing out, and he gave me the name of this guy to call. I called this guy, and it turns out he was the editor-in-chief of the only the only Hebrew language newspaper in all of the Soviet Union. And I had lunch with him, and he said that he had been told by Gorbachev to tell me a particular story. And he told me the story of this major UFO landing that had taken place outside of Moscow at this big soccer field on a Saturday or Sunday morning. The people were all out there playing in the park, and this big UFO came down and landed right in the park. And this one young man walked out toward it, and a big blue light came out, and this guy just disappeared, and the thing flew away. And all the people started calling in, and this Hebrew language newspaper guy sent one of his best reporters out to interview the people that were at the site still, and he was there interviewing all of them when the vehicle came back. It came back and landed, big blue light came out of it, and this guy just materialized and was standing there again. And this guy had seen the whole thing. And that's the guy that Gorbachev had personally referred me to talk to. So that was his response to my asking him this question. But he never said anything to me about his discussions with Reagan.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've been to Russia twice on UFO fact-finding trips and was able to obtain several thousand pages of previously classified, some still classified information to indicate that the Russians had their own secret studies that were widespread and ongoing, and they know a heck of a lot about it as well.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I know that to be true.
You mentioned the Vatican. Now, you were denied access to what the Vatican has in its files. What do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. It was kind of interesting when Marsh asked me for them. I was perfectly happy to try to get them. I had thought, given the status that I had as the legal counsel for the Jesuit order, it's the largest collection of Jesuits in the world here in the United States, so it's pretty influential. I thought we were going to be able to do this, and especially since the head of the Vatican Library is a Jesuit, I thought we were going to be able to get this done. But we got cut off on that, so I don't know what's in there. I mean, it would have been different if he said there was nothing, you know, there's nothing there, but he didn't say that. He just said that we couldn't have access to it.
Well, there are a lot of indications that the Vatican has had a long-standing interest in UFOs. I know that when I first started working on it back in the late 80s, I was contacted by the Vatican. They wanted me to send them files and tapes of the programs that I had had aired about Area 51, and they promised, look, they said that the Pope himself would view this stuff. Now, whether that's true, I don't know, but I never really got in. They had indicated that they would give me some feedback. That never happened. So
yeah, no, I don't know, because as you know, the relationship between the Jesuits in the Vatican has been a bit strained, you know, especially with Benedict that's in there now. You know, I mean, that Ratzinger was the head of the Commission on Orthodoxy for many years, and he's the one that suppressed a lot of the writings, the more creative and the theological writings of Jesuits. And so there's been quite a strain between the Jesuit order, which is much more progressive, very populist and supportive of citizens' movements and stuff like that, as distinct from the kind of really hierarchical, authoritarian type of attitude that's inside the Vatican at the present time.
Let me ask you about a missing person. This suggestion for a question came to me from a guy named Randy Kitcher in Manitoba, with whom I sometimes exchange correspondence, and he wanted to ask you about somebody, I guess, who was a friend of yours, a guy named John Maynard, who was a project disclosure witness who just basically vanished off the face of the earth. Do you have any insight into what happened to this guy and what he might have known?
No, I don't know where he went. I don't know.
I vetted
the many of the people that the actual 20 people that we presented at the disclosure project, because I was general counsel to the project, and I vetted a number of people, and I just don't recognize. I don't recall exactly what it is that he knew, because there were a lot of them. I don't remember right now what that was.
So you're unaware that he's vanished, basically.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
All right. Well, maybe Randy can send us some additional information.
Yeah.
And we'll figure out.
Have him get that to me, and I'll check it out.
Okay. And, you know, in sort of wrapping up what you've discovered and your experiences with conspiracies and secrecies and hiding the truth from, I mean, does it make you wonder whether democracy is real, whether we as citizens, supposedly of a free country, actually are in driving this car, are in control of our of things that happen in our lives, or whether other people are pulling these strings and there's not a darn thing we can do about it?
Well, I always think of the old Irish aphorism, George, where they say, you know, they used to refer to Ireland as the old sod. You know, it's all my Irish relatives, and they used to have this saying. They go, "Ha, well, the old sod isn't what it used to be, but then it never was." So it's important for us not to delude ourselves, you know, with our own fantasies about how democratic our society was in the past, and therefore because we're now grown up and we see the real thing here in front of us, that somehow, since it differs from the fiction that we all have about our past, that therefore things are much worse than it's ever been. The reality of it is, I mean, just look, we start out the show playing John Kennedy, and we still have this very warm and fuzzy feeling about John Kennedy and what a great guy he was and how wonderful those times were, et cetera. But the reality of it is that there was a very dark side to that whole thing. And, you know, that he in fact, authorized Project Camelot, which was a CIA program to identify student groups and stuff all through Latin America, that they would then the regimes down there would suppress and put in jail before elections, because Kennedy, so on one hand, he insisted that all of those countries down in South America, if they were going to continue to get U.S. military funding, had to hold public elections. And so what they said is, okay, we'll hold public elections, but you have to make sure that we win. And so John and the other people, you know, participated in providing information to them to identify people that they could round up that might be resistance people. There was all kinds of dark stuff that went on there that we didn't know about because we were younger back then. And we were all still in high school and doing our football games and being cheerleaders, and we all thought that everything was hunky-dory, but it wasn't. Now that we're grown up, we see that things aren't hunky-dory, and they're not. But the fact is that they aren't, up until this past administration, probably the administration of George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, up until 1980, things were not as good as we thought they were, but they sure weren't as bad as they are now. And things have gotten substantially worse. And this has been since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because not getting too technical about this, what happened is at the point of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the antithesis of world communism collapsed, the thesis that it had risen up to oppose, the thesis, the late 19th century thesis of Caucasian nation-state-based capitalism and imperialism that had become the organizing principle of the late 19th century that justified manifest destiny and the white man's burden in the colonialization of Aboriginal peoples around the world by the Caucasian northern hemisphere. You know, that whole organizing ethic was the thesis that was challenged by world communism. And when that antithesis collapsed, what you got was a reactive response in which they just all retreated back to the late 19th century theory. And it was, and that's what we really faced with the neocons. The neocons weren't neoconservatives, they were reactionaries. That's what we've gone through over the past 20 years, and that's what we really have to dig out and undo and get back to our democracy.
Thank you, Dan. And we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines and let you folks get into this as well. Stick around. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We've had two fascinating hours with Dan Sheehan, an attorney who also is a co-founder of something called the New Paradigm Institute. Before we open up the phone lines, Danny, I thought I might give you a chance to plug this institute, what it does, and how regular citizens might get involved in what you're doing if they so choose.
Well, this is a 501c3 public interest organization that has resulted from the State of the World Forum with Gorbachev and Alan Cranston and Ted Turner. That this is an attempt to establish the understanding of what the alternative worldviews are that range all the way from the authoritarian worldview to the reactionary worldview to the conservative worldview to the moderate worldview, to the liberal worldview, to the progressive worldview, to the utopian worldview, and the understanding of what the final worldview is in this octave set of worldviews that are held by the human family, which is this new extraterrestrial worldview. This whole new worldview that's going to come in when people come to grips with the reality that we not only are not the center of the universe that we once thought, but that in fact we are not in fact the pinnacle of all evolution, that there are other sentient, highly intelligent civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy. And the fact is that we're part of a galactic community. This is a new worldview that needs to be understood, but it needs to be understood in the context of the other worldviews, because most people hear these terms thrown around of this person is a liberal or this person is a fascist or this person is sort of deadly moderate, you know, but the fact is they don't know what those worldviews are all about. They don't know that each one of those worldviews has its own unique cosmology or theory of how the universe actually came into being. Each one of them has their own unique teleology or theory of how the world is unfolding, what's to be expected in the immediate future pursuant to the way the world is unfolding. They each have their own theory as to how human consciousness actually came into being, you know, from an otherwise inert matter in the universe. How did consciousness come into being? Or did it, in fact, pre-exist the entire universe? Has there existed an infinite and eternal sea of entirely undifferentiated consciousness that actually enfolded into being the original unit of matter as a singularity within the field of consciousness. Now, these are all things that people don't spend a lot of time thinking about, but depending upon how you answer those questions, it will determine what mode of ethical reasoning you actually use to try to address the solution to problems that we face in our human family. And whatever mode of ethical reasoning you use will determine what philosophy you have, and what political philosophy you have, and what mode of spiritual expression you'll have. These are sets. There's a whole set of 10 very major specific beliefs that make up a worldview, and there's an entire octave of worldviews. All this discussion we've been having tonight that talks about reactionaries like George W. Bush, how they're distinguished from mere conservatives like George Bush Sr., how they're differentiated from liberals like John Edwards, or progressives like Dennis Kucinich. You know, these are things that people need to know in order to make intelligent choices, and more importantly, to prepare ourselves for the new upcoming worldview that is going to come upon us once we actually have established to the complete knowledge of everybody in the world that this extraterrestrial civilization does exist. So this new Paradigm Institute exists to communicate this information to people. It's a spin-off from the State of the World Forum of Gorbachev, and it is the progeny of the old Christic Institute. The Christic Institute engaged in this long-time dialectic of investigating and challenging the secrecy of our country, and we realize that the time has come now that rather than just confronting these people in sort of demonizing them, we have to bring everybody together around the table for peace and reconciliation to understand that all of these worldviews have their place. None of them is completely evil. None of them is completely perfect. But when we bring them all together, just as we bring together all of the primary colors of the spectrum, the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, when you bring all of these major seven colors together and shine them onto a single spot, you get clear white light. This is the symbol of the New Paradigm Institute, and this is what we've been doing. This is what we were doing in hopes of establishing a new worldview to present to the United Nations right after the beginning of the new millennium. We were going to be calling together all 189 world presidents and presenting this new worldview to them when 9/11 occurred, and the reactionaries seized control of the United States government, used this as an excuse to create a whole new world of ultimate enemies, and we have to reject that. We have to firmly reject that, and we have to reestablish trust among ourselves in the world, and we need to not only learn to tolerate, but to actively understand and appreciate everyone else's worldview and come together in unison to establish a genuinely new millennium, to basically understand that the Cold World is over, the Cold War is over, and we need to regroup now that the Cold War is over, and establish a new worldview and prepare for what is coming with our contact with an extraterrestrial civilization.
Okay, it's called the New Paradigm Institute, and if people want to know more about it, newparadigminstitute.org. You can find it on the net. There might even be links on the Coast to Coast site as well. I just want to emphasize before we go to the phones here that what Dan is saying, and as, to go back to what I said earlier, these are political issues. No question about it. And a lot of his harshest criticism has been aimed at Republican administrations. But as Dan has said, no one is pure in this sort of thing, that a lot of folks, a lot of Democrats have helped to perpetuate the secrecy and have been involved in conspiracies as well. So I encourage everyone, as you're calling in, go ahead and ask tough questions. But let's remember that Mr. Sheehan is our guest here. Okay. We can have a good, honest discussion about these things. So I think we're going to try to take one call before we go to the first break in this half hour. I'm going to go to Jeff on the first-time caller line. Jeff calling from North Carolina. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi, George. Hi, Danny. Jeff. Great show. I agree with everything that you said, but I'm not as optimistic as you are. This country's been taught to buy these people's fraud. It's patriotic to do that. And I think the idea that these people would let go is just not realistic.
Well, that's one of the things, again, without being, you know, advocational exclusively about Edwards, you hear what John Edwards is saying. He said, look, The fact of the matter is that to think that you can just sit down at the table with these people and give them their place at the table, if you give them their place at the table, these major transnational corporations, they'll eat all the food, or they'll at least take 95% of the food and leave the remainder for everyone else. So John is saying that you need to confront them. You need to challenge them. You need to take this power away from them. This is the second time they've done this. They did this between 1868 and 1917, the robber baron era, the whole Gilded Age era of the huge monopolies and the big trusts that were established. That what they did is they drove our country right into total bankruptcy with the collapse of the stock market in 1929. This is, you've heard mentioned several times during the course of the discussion tonight, the potential pending gloom that people hear coming up with 2012, the potential complete collapse of the economy, the collapse of the environment, the collapse of our country is a beacon of hope for the people of the world. This, I still continue to realize that we faced this before, and we have challenged it, and we have met the challenge in the past, but we need to do so consciously. This power needs to be taken from them. But I'll say this in closing. I pointed out that we have these different worldviews that span all the way from the extreme right wing all the way to the extreme left wing, but this reactionary worldview is the lower manifestation of the second paradigm worldview. There is a higher manifestation that is not dialectical, but it is binary. It is, in fact, the Tao. Instead of seeing things as black and white, good guys and bad guys, we see them just as the yin and the yang. That there is a dance that goes on between feminine and masculine energy, between the different kind of cultures, between Western civilization and Eastern civilization. This is something that can be seen as a constructive dynamic if we truly appreciate it and view it in a positive and optimistic way. But we need to take the lead on this. We need to, as the people who have for the last 8 years at least, invaded countries, attempted to seize the oil fields in the Middle East, to actually have led Saddam Hussein into invading Kuwait. You know, George Bush on July 11th of 1991 sent a personal handwritten communique to Saddam Hussein stating that if Saddam Hussein chose to use military force against Kuwait to resolve his dispute with the border with them, that the United States would not view it as a serious matter. And as soon as they did it, then the Secretary of Defense under George Bush Sr., at that time Dick Cheney, contacted Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador to the United States from Saudi Arabia, and lied to him and said that we had intelligence indicating that Saddam Hussein was going to, after invading Kuwait, invade Saudi Arabia.
Danny, I'm going to have to stop you here. We need to take a short break. We'll come back with more calls in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're speaking with attorney Dan Sheehan, and you've been listening. Boy, you know he's quite a firecracker on some of this stuff. We're going to go back to the phones now. East of the Rockies, TJ in Minnesota. What's on your mind? Are you there?
TJ, are you out there? I think we lost TJ.
We are losing TJ there, so we'll go to west of the Rockies, Blair in Sedona.
Hi, George. Good evening, and good evening, Daniel.
Hi, Blair.
I have a sort of a theory that our electronic voting machine experiment in the electoral process is really not a very good idea.
That's true.
Do you remember back in 2004 when Howard Dean let out his big yell?
Yes.
Yelp, and that was the turn of the tide, and John Kerry took over? Do you think the electronic voting machine process had something to do with getting a weaker candidate in?
Well, no. We're talking about the Diebold voting machine corporation. I was involved in conducting some of the investigations in Florida and Ohio following the 2004 election, and there was ample evidence indicating that there was major fraud being used with those Diebold machines. There's one of the major objectives that's going to be undertaken immediately following the identification of the nominees for both the Republican and Democratic Party here in February is going to be to try to eliminate the use of these Diebold machines in both Ohio and Florida. Among other states. So that's going to be a very important issue that's got to be dealt with. We need to either have a direct verifiable paper trail of what the original vote was that was cast, or better yet, to eliminate those particular machines. And even if it's a little less efficient and not quite as spectacularly immediate for the media around the country, having dramatic immediate results, I think it's going to be much more reliable, and it's going to restore the trust of the American people in the voting system.
Thanks, Blair. Thanks for the call. We're going to go to our wild card one line, David in Palmdale, California, a town that has a lot of interesting stuff flying around out there. David, what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, we do have a lot of interesting stuff. Actually, what I've done is I've actually sent you a link of an article that came out today. And you're on the Democratic side, Daniel, but have you know Bilderberg? I'm sure you're familiar with the Bilderberg group.
Oh, sure, sure.
There is an author who's written a book, Daniel Estulin. I can't pronounce his last name. Anyways, this book, he has insiders in the Bilderberg that he does get information from. There's a candidate running for president. We raised $5 million in 24 hours today. We raised $4.5 million on November 5th. Apparently, Bilderberg inside the top people there are talking about assassination.
Who are you saying? Ron Paul is going to be assassinated?
It is on the table. Yes. And I want to get it out there because don't mess with our guy. Because, I mean, they want a real revolution. This man speaks the truth. He goes out there and he speaks the truth about the North American Union, about the coming Euro, or the Mary Euro, and he's put his butt out there on the line for us.
Okay, David, point made. It's on the record. We are forewarned. We're going to go to a wild card two line, John in Phoenix. John?
Hi, George.
Hey, good morning.
And nice to be with you tonight. I wondered if your guest could give me a little clarification on you mentioned his service or being retained by the Jesuit order. Is he still in that capacity?
No. I was chief counsel for the Jesuits from 1975 to 1985. It was during the primary period when the major operations were going on in Latin America to attempt to organize peasants and stuff through the Jesuits into cooperatives, farmers' cooperatives, etc. In 1985, when Pedro Arrupe passed away, who was the superior of the order, I moved on and founded the Christic Institute that worked with all 54 of the major religious denominations in the entire United States.
Okay, so would you say you were an advocate of liberation, so-called liberation theology then in that time?
Well, actually, I had a lot of criticisms of liberation theology. I thought that my own personal opinion was that it, in fact, tended to substitute an almost entirely secular analysis for the source of problems.
And sir, would you say you're a practicing Catholic now?
Oh, yes. I go to Mass every Sunday. I was there this morning through the snow in the winters of Iowa. So I go to the Mass every Sunday.
I'm kind of confused by that because I see your co-founder on the Institute is a young lady or a woman who served as Labor Secretary for the National Organization for Women.
That's right.
Which, of course, is a overtly pro-abortion organization, and wondered if you have any problems in that.
One of the things you'll discover, John, I don't know if you're married, but you're one is not responsible for the political positions of one's wife.
Oh, as a matter of fact, one is, in fact, I just tell you, George, I didn't think time warps existed, but it's amazing listening to your guest and reading some of the stuff on the website. It's like being transported right back to 1968 because all the things tied to this guest are hard left items. And I just ask one last question: you talk about getting the world leaders together. So you think that a Ahmadinejad who says that he'll wipe Israel off the face of the map deserves a seat at the table along with a guy like Kim Jong Il who starved his population?
Oh, well, one
feel good about talking with those kind of guys.
All of the candidates, all the way from through the entire Republicans and the Democrats, all acknowledge that what we're going to have to do in order to solve the problems that exist now with regard to Iraq is we're going to have to sit down with the leadership of not only Iran, but Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in all the countries of the world, to have discussions with them. One doesn't have to succumb to their position. You know that obviously in the free play of ideas, if a person sits down and sets forth ridiculous ideas, such as he does, and saying that he doesn't believe that the Holocaust even happened, you know that the lack of merit of his arguments are going to be obvious on the face of them, and he's not going to have much influence. But one can't completely exclude him from being able to participate in the conversations. So that all the candidates and all the parties acknowledge that we have to have dialogue with these people. It doesn't mean you have to believe their positions or accept their positions, but we have to talk with everybody.
Thanks very much for the call. These are pointed questions. These are difficult issues, so there are disagreements about these things, but at least we can have a rational and
sure.
fairly polite conversation about them. Do we have time for one more call before we go to the break? Anyone? We'll try one more. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line, Peter in New Jersey.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Hi, Peter.
Mr. Sheehan, I have a question for you. I have two questions, really. Now, since you brought up the Bilderbergs, are they connected in any way to the Rockefellers?
The Bilderbergs, there's a book that you should read about this. It has some deep discussions about this. There's a fellow by the name of Peter Dale Scott. He has written a book that is called The Road to 9/11. And he talks about the differences in these different kind of secret societies that exist in the gatherings of these different people and how some of them are involved with the Rockefellers. David Rockefeller in the Council on Foreign Relations is different from the Bilderberger group itself. And there's even some divisions, for example, between David Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller. But that's a book that would really be very helpful for people to understand this. It's Peter Dale Scott. Book that's called The Road to 9/11, and that'll discuss the differences and distinctions among all those different groups.
I'll tell you what, Peter, hang on with your second question. We'll come back to you after the break. Stick around for Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We have a short time period left with our guest, Dan Sheehan, and a lot of you have things you want to say to him. The phone lines are lit up, and we're going to get to as many of your calls as we can. We're going to go to Davita in Kansas City on the wildcard line. Davita, what's on your mind?
Hi. Okay, I have a couple of things. The first one is, you know, that while I really like the idea of peace and reconciliation, and frankly, Edwards is my candidate of choice, I just feel like the public will not respond positively to that if there aren't some limits to it. I mean, where we're talking high treason on the part of officials, you know, in whom the public trust was placed, particularly in the highest office and offices of this country, I just don't think that you can say you're not going to pursue, charges of treason when that would be appropriate. You know, and I don't know how you get their cooperation short of that, but I just don't, because, you know, this is why Ford lost the election to Carter, because he pardoned Nixon. I mean, the people just aren't going to go for that. I think when you really get to when you really throw the doors open to those dark closets, you're going to find that the corruption goes back to World War II, and there were acts of high treason and murder involved, for one thing. And so that's my first point, you know.
Okay, then we're going to go to Danny and let him answer that. Dan, you want to address that?
Yes, I hear you there. I really do. And it's a major issue that needs to be addressed, because that I've been working for 35 years to try to get these things addressed, and it's become perfectly evident to me that to attempt to bring these people to the bar of justice, to get them prosecuted for these types of crimes, especially and the problem is that crimes like treason and others have statutes of limitations. That, you know, that if you don't prosecute these people within 5 years of the commission of their crime, then the statutes of limitations that apply to any crimes tend to run. Now, with murder, it's different. With actual assassinations and murders, there is no statute of limitations. But with regard to all these other crimes, there are statutes of limitations that places them beyond the reach of the law. And so that what I'm saying is that with regard to a lot of those types of crimes, we have to openly agree that those people are not going to be prosecuted under the present system, but we have to give them immunity in order to have them come in to testify, just like they did in South Africa. We need to get that done. Now, I know that with regard to the most recent administration in the last 8 years, there's a lot of extremely hard feelings that run to them, that there's with these renditions and the torturing that's gone on, et cetera, that I think that it's really, really important that we find out what all the details of this are, and because it's so important that we demonstrate to the outside world that we have a desire to get this stuff exposed. Now, you're right. that if we just expose it and then forgive them, the people, a lot of people in the rest of the world are going to say, oh, well, wasn't that helpful? You know, you admitted everything and you let all your people go and didn't punish them at all. These people are still potentially subject to international prosecution in the international courts of justice. We're going to have a very intense discussion about that among our people, about what we want to do about this. But I think it's going to be extremely important that we get these facts put out on the table so that we can understand what happened, acknowledge what it is that happened, and start to take the systematic steps that are necessary to keep it from ever happening again in the future.
Okay, thank you, Danny, for that answer. DeVita, if you want to hang on, we're going to take a short break. If you want to hang on, we'll try to get to one more of your questions and then try to open up to other callers. We'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We have a few minutes left with our guest, Dan Sheehan, an attorney from the New Paradigm Institute. We were talking to DeVita in Kansas City. DeVita, a lot of people waiting to get on, so I'm going to ask you to get right to the point.
Okay, the second part of it was I was going to ask him if they would, he believes that Senator Edwards' presidency would also focus on remedying the unfortunate suffering of the people that have been, victimized by this regime of secrecy and dark dealings, like Leonard Peltier, whose petition for clemency has been languishing since 1993.
Danny, that's something you know about, don't you?
Yeah, I will personally present that to John because I actually was the ACLU lawyer for Wounded Knee for the American Indian Movement in No Pelletier. And so that will be one of the very first things that I present to John by way of potential presidential pardons.
Thanks, DeVita. We're going to go to Simone in Chicagoland. Simone, good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I would like to ask regarding the UFO that landed in Russia and the blue beam came out. What year did that happen?
Well, it's not. I at this exact moment, I'm not certain. I found out about this in 1994. Pardon?
I have a reason for asking it. If you'd like to hear it.
Okay, sure. What was it?
Make it quick.
I was in the Air Force, and I worked in a cable traffic message center, like the one in the movie, The Falcon and the Snowman, and had a high clearance, and I came into an unauthorized possession of the tracking of a UFO that went into near Moscow, and it was an eyes-only level paper, and they got me to turn it back in by telling me that it was a hoax document, but I was put under investigation for espionage, spying for the Soviet Union for the next 7 months of my life. And I only gave you a molecule-sized soundbite. It's a long story. Anyway, I got my FOIA files in the early 90s, at least documenting that this happened to me.
Hey, so Simone, why don't you send me some of that stuff? Email it to me. I'd like to get a look at it. And Danny, do you think that you took notes with that meeting with the Russian newspaper editor, where you might have indicated where and when that crash had taken place or that incident took place?
I didn't take the notes. I was sitting with him at a table in a restaurant, and just he was telling me the story. But I can find out. I can find out when that particular incident took place. I'm sure I can, George, and I'll find that for you.
Okay, east of the Rockies, Joe in New Orleans. What's going on?
Hey, how you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. My question concerns the information that your guest has looked at. Has he ever read across different secret societies and their agendas as far as moving the economy and just basically disrupting the world order?
Well, there's lots of information around, Joe, about these things. The peculiar thing is that each of these particular issues that I have the personal information about have come to me because I've actually been retained as an attorney to do the investigation. In Watergate, you know, I was in F. Lee Bailey's office, and we represented James McCord. We got him to write the letter to Judge Sirica that blew the whistle on the plumbers and Nixon. You know, I was at the Pentagon Papers, and we represented the New York Times. The other things that are just general information about some of these other groups, I've never had any particular occasion to do any specific professional investigation of that. So I don't pretend to have any particular unique knowledge about it. All I know is what things are in books like Peter Dale Scott's books and other things. So I know that there's significant indications that they exist and that they're engaged in very high level discussions about wanting to have influence and effect upon our economy. But I don't really have any special knowledge about that, and I wouldn't like to pretend that I do.
Okay.
Anything else, Joe?
Contacted by a group called the Nouveau Tech Society.
Oh no, I don't know about them.
Right. They were looking to. They're a technology type group.
Oh, far out. I don't know about them.
Well, you'll have to tell us more about it at some point. We're going to go now to west of the Rockies, Marie in Tempe.
Yes. Hi. Thank you both for doing such an excellent show. This is so wonderful. First of all, can I elect Dan for president? Seriously, be an excellent.
There's so many candidates out there now. It's hard to keep them. Hard to keep.
But I want to make sure that our vote counts. Anywhere else, it's not going to count. So I'll do it on coast to coast, and then we'll see who agrees with me. The other thing is Kucinich brought House Bill 333 to bring impeachment charges.
Yes.
Against Cheney.
Yes.
And now Wexler and two other congressmen are asking for hearings. I think that's the least we could do, but I would like your opinion.
Oh yes, I think that I have no doubt whatsoever that the activities of Cheney and Bush and Elliot Abrams and several other of the high-ranking officials are subject to impeachment. I tried to get impeachment resolutions brought against Bush Sr. because of his involvement in Iran-Contra. It's the difficulty is that the impeachment process is ultimately a political activity, and what the Democratic Party that's in charge of the House and Senate, the House that would have to return the articles of impeachment and the Senate that would have to try him, what they're saying is that, look, there's only 1 year left before we have a political election here, and that it would take more than a year to get the whole political process to take place. And that's what they keep asserting as to why they won't do it. I tend to agree with Dennis Kucinich, who, as I said earlier, I was his national policy chief in 2004. I agree that you should not allow just completely political considerations to stop you from meeting your constitutional responsibilities as a representative to present these resolutions in Congress and to try to force them to a vote. I think this should be done personally.
Thanks, Marie. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Corey in Davenport, Iowa, on our first-time caller. Apparently is up there pretty close to where you are right now, Dan. Corey, what's on your mind?
Good morning to you both. I just had a question about what would Mr. Sheehan think about instituting some form of, say, like a disclosure amnesty so that some of the people who would come forward would not so much face criminal charges. They might lose their position and, you know, but they wouldn't so much go to jail or have fear of lawsuits and other things that might come from some of their actions that they've done.
Well, that is precisely what we're talking about. That's exactly what was done that Bishop Tutu handled in South Africa, that it was granting them immunity against criminal prosecution and civil liability in order to get the benefit of their sworn testimony to give details about how this stuff happened and who was exactly involved in it. And they will, in fact, of course, be relieved of any kind of government position that they have and any future employment, but that they would be immunized against criminal prosecution and civil liability. That would be the theory of this.
And one other quick question was that what are your theories on there's been people who've talked about that we are currently in a campaign of controlled disclosure, whereas they let out information to the public at a pace that they figure that we could adjust to things a little bit easier.
Well, there's a lot of stuff written about that, in that it is clear that over the years bits of information have been being dragged out of them. My direct experience is that the nature of the resistance that we're getting to any attempts to get this information out seems to be entirely vigorous on their part, that they're not doing this voluntarily, that we're dragging this out of them. Very much the same way with the Kennedy assassination. You know, it's not as though there's been some decision made on the part of the people that were involved to reveal this information. It's just that over a long period of time, we're extracting this information from them piece by piece and assembling it. I think that's what's really happening. There's all kinds of rumors around about certain splits that are going on inside the internal group like MJ-12, that there's a majority of them that want to release this, but there's a group blocking them. It's hard to say at this point. That I'm historically not in the business of guessing. I'm in the business of finding out. And so that I think that there needs to be a major a gathering of people in the UFO community to mount a really well-funded professional investigation with Class A licensed professional investigators, just like we used in the Karen Silkwood case, just like we used in the Iran-Contra case. This is what we really need to do to finally get at this information. And if, in fact, a new administration comes in under John Edwards or even perhaps Obama or others, that we are going to have a much better chance of having leverage inside those administrations. But we may well still have to mount a major litigation and investigation to get at this key piece of secret information.
Thanks, Corey. We're going to go to Tom in Michigan, who's been hanging on the wild card line for quite some time. Good morning, Tom.
How are you guys doing tonight?
Hey, Tom. Okay. Thanks.
I'd like to relate local government to how maybe national and world government would operate. I just bought a house here in Michigan, and I had to pay the upkeep on the property, you know, like the lawn mowing and stuff. Well, I didn't own the property.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Tom, keep in mind we got about 3 minutes left, so.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, but anyway, to make a long story short, I'm being charged like $100 a lawn mow here, and how would I take J.P. Morgan to small claims court? They're the ones that owned the property previously to me.
Just call the local legal aid society, bud. Call the legal aid society and go meet with them and ask them to initiate the case for you. They'll do it.
Thank you for the call. Isidore in New York on the wild card line. What's on your mind?
Hi. Something's on my mind. I'm sorry to change the subject. It has been reported that about 50 years ago, both the USSR and USA each dumped 20,000 55-gallon barrels of nuclear waste into their respective offshore ocean waters, which circle the globe. And that in about 20 years, those barrels would start leaking. Could that explain global warming?
No, you would have been able to detect the higher levels of radiation within those currents, Isidore, if that had been taking place. The tracking of the relationship of the release of global glasses into the atmosphere, global greenhouse gases, has very clearly been now connected by the International Panel on Climate Control. Some 2,000 international scientists have been able to track exactly what is causing the global warming, and it's not that release of potential radiation into the water. And there have been certain pockets where they found this. For example, off San Francisco, there are two hot pockets where some radiation has been dumped. They're trying to dig that up, but there doesn't seem to be any really credible evidence to support a report like that.
Thanks for the call, Isidore. Appreciate it. We've got just about a minute or so left here, Dan. Maybe you could sort of sum up where you think things are going and how people can get involved.
Yeah, I think that the key is for people to get involved right now. We have one of the most vigorous debates going on in the history of American politics right now. It's a wide open field. This is the first time that there has not been an incumbent president or a vice president that's running for office for the presidency, and there's going to be a major new administration from one group or another that's coming in. I think everybody should become vigorously involved in this campaign and work hard to get your candidate elected, whoever they happen to be, and we need to mobilize compromise now, because we are only, remember, whoever it is that gets elected president this next year is going to be the president when 2012 comes around. And whatever the events are that are getting ready to happen in 2012, we want to have a person in that office who can be responsible and take charge at this time. And that's what we really need to focus on now. And we need to use our time between now and then to try to bring out as much of these terrible things that have happened in our past, come to grips with them, and establish institutional structures that can stop this from happening in the future. Because, as President Kennedy said at the very beginning of this thing, this is what is the major enemy of our country. It is not just some major group in the Middle East or in Russia or in China. This is something that we can take care of, and we are the 6% of the population of the entire human family that exists in this country, and we can, in fact, bring this country back to make it the shining city on the hill that it has promised the world that it would be.
Dan Sheehan, thanks very much. It's been an interesting couple of hours with you. I know the Coast to Coast audience had not heard you on this program before. They certainly know you now, and it's just been a fascinating conversation. It's certainly, regardless of where people are on the political spectrum, these are things we need to talk about and truths that need to be uncovered. So thanks for joining us. And if people want more information about Dan, you can contact his New Paradigm Institute. You can find it on the web. Also, thanks to Chris O'Brien. Chris, buddy, that was great stuff. I promise we'll have you back on. And if you're looking for folks, if you haven't finished your Christmas shopping, his book, Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, would make an excellent gift for someone on your UFO list. I want to say thanks to all the folks at Premier Radio and George Norrie, Lisa and Gina and Dan and everybody and my hosts here at KXNT. Merry Christmas to all of you. Happy New Year. Be safe out there, and I'll be back next month.